Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people from England, Thailand, and India will start dropping in. They'll be asking ethical questions too often missed by mainstream media. Whether combating climate change will stop us from flying. How economies can survive without tourists. And when travel can be truly sustainable. I'm Chris Richards, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, Chris Brazier, who, like me, is a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine. Chris has just been producing a magazine about ethical travel. And while there was lots of dynamic dilemmas that he dealt with during his journey, one very contentious challenge captured the debate. To fly or not to fly? That is the question. So now that we're more conscious of combating climate change, cutting back on carbon emissions is high on the list. So how much carbon are we dumping into our atmosphere by travelling on a plane, Chris?
A lot is the short answer to that. I was really shocked when I first started investigating this magazine to find just how much carbon is dumped into the atmosphere every time we get on a plane. The statistic carried in our magazine was for a return flight to London to New York would dump 1,700 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent into the atmosphere. Now, of course, that doesn't mean anything to anyone unless you compare it with something else. So I set some other comparisons beside it. Your refrigerator for 1 year would dump only about 100 kilograms of CO2 equivalent into the atmosphere, so 17 times less. The statistic that really got me most, though, was that the total amount of electricity and gas that my household uses in heating it for a year is just about equivalent to the amount that you would spend on that kind of flight from London to New York. Well, that seemed a truly shocking thing, given how hard we try and limit our emissions in those terms and cut down on heating and so on in order to reduce those things, that flying could have such an impact as that. I found truly mind-boggling.
Because there's some other factors that actually make that picture worse, isn't there? For instance, the height of a plane, the what's called contails in a plane actually exacerbate the actual greenhouse effect of flying.
Well, planes fly in the upper atmosphere, and the emissions that they produce there have a greater impact because they're that much higher. There are also, as you mentioned, contrails, that's water vapour, which also makes a contribution to global warming, and nitrous oxide also, emissions that are not normally considered. So when we talk about carbon dioxide equivalent, what we're doing in air travel, we're coming up with a sort of global figure, which is not all carbon. It does include those other elements. That's why we attach the term equivalent.
Right. And there's a difference between short-term and long-term flights, isn't there? I've been actually thinking that because I live in Australia and our head office is in Oxford, that my carbon emissions from flying might be much worse than somebody who's, for instance, flying from London to Aberdeen. But that's actually not the case, is it?
Well, it is the case in the sense that you're travelling much further and there will be a bigger carbon contribution as a result of that. But short-haul flights are more damaging than long-haul in the sense that the vast acceleration power required to push the aeroplane up on takeoff and coming down is so much greater than it is when you're cruising at a high altitude. So if you make very many short-haul flights, then you're going to do a lot more damage than if you take one long-haul flight.
Right.
So your conscience can be a little clearer on that.
So moving on to other forms of travel and the carbon footprint that they leave, I was disappointed to see that a sleeper compartment in a train is right up there, Chris. How come?
Simply because a sleeper compartment takes up an enormous amount more space on a train than a seat does, I'm afraid. I also was disappointed to find this out because it seems we want to encourage the use of trains as an alternative to planes, and a sleeper compartment is obviously a comfortable way of doing that.
So what is the most carbon neutral way to travel then?
You're asking me difficult questions here, aren't you? I mean, the depressing thing to say is that the most ethical thing to do is not to travel at all, which is so depressing. none of us living in the modern world are able to make that that kind of contribution. We are simply not prepared not to travel. We can't all just cultivate our allotment and do nothing else. And so we need to make choices, you know, choose the form of travel with the least impact. And we need to be encouraging trains while thinking about what kind of fuel they're using too. Because, for example, people might go on a train through France from Britain and not realise that all the power from that is derived from nuclear power. It's a very complicated picture. And what I tried to do in the magazine was steer as clear as much as possible from those statistical problems and calculations and really just talk about the ethical dilemma, the impact, recognising when we travel, especially when we fly, but also when we travel in cars and trains, we are outputting carbon into the atmosphere, and that is contributing to the huge problem of global warming, and we need to take account of that.
Yes.
And how do we take account of that? The ethical dilemma results.
Well, so far as consumers are concerned, carbon emission cutbacks might well fuel the fear of flying. Add on increased oil prices, meaning more expensive seats on gas-guzzling planes, and you've got two big reasons why plane travel might be in for a bumpy landing. The question is, what's going to happen to all those economies when the steady stream of tourists coming through airports tapers to a trickle? Bali, in Indonesia, gives us a glimpse. In 2002, bombs detonated in and around a popular tourist pub killed 202 people. In 2005, more bombs in tourist areas killed another 20. Tourists starting avoided Bali like the plague. Author and journalist Cameron Forbes has just dropped into our studio. His latest book is Under the Volcano, The Story of Bali. Cameron, what happened to the people of Bali when the tourists stopped coming?
An economic downturn. The Balinese economy has been growingly for decades, dependent on tourism. There's probably about 17% people directly employed, but if you look at the flow-on effects of that, more than half of the Balinese GDP or income is based around tourism. Given the other pressures in Bali, the pressures of population, the fact that farming is no longer a total way of life, you can't be a subsistence farmer in Bali anymore. The only avenue of employment really is in the service industries. The interesting thing is that since the bombings, they're now going up to record levels again. There'll probably be about 2 million people visiting Bali in the next year or so. And the estimate by some economists is that 1 million visitors is associated with 420,000 jobs.
Heavens. And there's another economic dimension, isn't there, in terms of employment? You said that 50% are dependent on some kind of tourism dollar through Bali. There's migrant workers who are coming into Bali as well to service that industry. So it's bolstering other parts of Indonesia as well, effectively.
It's both bolstering other parts of Indonesia and also causing stress within Bali. As people are probably aware, Bali is a Hindu island, literally in a Muslim sea. About 87% of the population of Bali are Hindu. It's been a Hindu holdout against the march of Islam since about the 14th century. There is a siege mentality in Bali about the problems of Islamification.
So that's one of the effects of tourism, that it's actually skewed that particular religious mix. What are the other effects of tourism in terms of changing the island and the island's economy?
Well, it certainly changed. If you go back, my first visit to Bali, I suppose, was in about 1972. I went there with the words of Pandit Nehru ringing in my ears that Bali was the morning of the world. And certainly it was a place of gorgeous beauty. Though, as with any developing country, if you strayed a little, you'd find pockets of poverty. But the drive of tourism, the expansion of tourism, has led, of course, to the uglification of Bali to some extent. There are areas, there are streets which are festooned with power lines. There's growing pollution. The demands of tourism itself has meant that land, and land which is a basic religious and cultural linchpin of the society, land is being sold, sometimes almost forcibly sold. Farmers in poverty are selling land towards tourist development. There have been ecological disasters like carving freeways to make it easier for the tourist punters to get from the airport to a luxury hotel. And the other thing, of course, is that a luxury hotel in a country where water is of so much importance because of the sacredness of water in all of the ceremonies, but also in feeding the rice cultivation, which leads to that marvellous man-created shades of green. Well, a five-star tourist hotel will use, say, 2,300 litres of water per room, whereas an ordinary Balinese will use 77 litres of water a day.
Heavens.
So there is this competition for water. And, of course, you've got to have a golf course, haven't you? I mean, one of the world's most absurd games of all. And, of course, yeah, precious Balinese water is being used on the golf courses.
And so does that mean that tourism is a road of no return, that, in fact, you skew the economy a particular way and you can't come back to that?
Oh, there are some people who look towards an almost romantic past of Bali. The vision of Bali as a paradise was first of all invented by the Dutch in the early 20th century. The Dutch were bloody colonists. They were terrible. Only about 6 years after the last of their drives against to subjugate the Balinese in 1908, the Dutch were broadcasting Bali as a paradise. If you come to this paradise, you'll never forget it. Sukarno, who was half Balinese and is adored by a lot of the Balinese, he was the one who took Nehru there and Tito there and Khrushchev there and so many people, because he saw Bali as a source of foreign exchange. But he also saw Bali as a showcase for the strange, in a way, mess that is Indonesia. So the version of Bali as paradise has been a created version. When I first started to research my book, they said you could say, Bali, paradise lost. I said, never was a paradise. Mm. And the point that Chris was making, and I think you were making about why travel, the point about Bali, and particularly with Australian travel to Bali, is you fly into the airport, you go straight to a sort of enclave, a beach strip. You can go to bars which will be decorated in the colour of a rugby league or Australian rules team. Beer, beer, beer and more beer. No relationship with
local culture.
Local culture.
Yeah, indeed. The bombings happened at Paddy's Bar, didn't they?
At Paddy's Bar and the Sari Club. And the Sari Club was a place where Balinese were banned unless they were accompanied by foreigners.
I'm going to bring Chris Brazier into our conversation now. Chris was in Bali in 2006. So what are your observations, Chris?
I have, as you say, much less experience of Bali, but I did go there first in 1981 and came back again in 2006. So I was able to witness a generation of change and the impact of tourism on the country. I must say, in 1981, despite all that Karen says about the construction of the myth of Bali as a paradise, I did see it pretty much as a paradise there. It was such a wonderful place to visit, seeing life go on there, and the integrity of Balinese culture, the way that they had managed to hold on, as you say, to their own Hinduism or their own particular mix of Hinduism and animism against the sea of Islam that surrounds it, and retain that sense of integrity in relation to the tourists who were coming in, Western ideas and so on, seemed remarkable. And though I was shocked when I went back in 2006 by the scale of the tourist development, you know, by finding a McDonald's here and luxury hotels where previously I had only seen grass huts or whatever, I did still feel, talking to people, that somehow the Balinese did manage to retain that very independent sense of the value of their own culture, despite the grossness of some of the Western impositions that tourism had brought to the island. And it almost seemed to me like Bali was an unusual case in the world of somewhere that was so strong in its own sense of cultural confidence that it was actually able to take the tourist dollars and apply them to useful purposes within their own island, but reject a lot of the rest and just hold on to what's important to them. Do you think that's true, Karen?
I think that's true. I think there's a problem, though, if there is the continuing breakup of the village structure. As you know, the customary law, Desa Adat, is dependent so much on the links to the village. I still think that there is the problem, and it's a worldwide problem, of the bright lights of the big city, the breaking down of traditional structures. The other thing is that after the second bombing, a campaign was basically started by the Bali Post, which was called Ajig Bali, and it was very hard to get a definition of Ajig Bali. It was Bali strong. It was what it came down to. And the feeling was that they had to go back deeper into the old ways of religion. They had to hold strong to those. This was taken to some excess by some of the more radical Hindu Balinese who wanted to talk about Ajig Hindu, Bali for the Balinese, by which they meant the Hindu Balinese. I've got a friend, a young Chinese poet, who's been there for about three generations, and he's really concerned that the attitude towards himself as a Balinese, he thinks he's a Balinese, and he's also concerned that with this siege mentality also, that the Desa Adat rule is becoming much stricter, not just towards the outsiders, but to the Balinese themselves. The basis of Bali is balance between good and evil. This is why they have that marvellous once-a-hundred-year ceremony, which is a universal exorcism, just the most marvellous thing, where all the evil spirits are going to be driven away. And the Balinese felt that they were doing this not just for Bali, of course, but for the whole world. Mm. So the sense of balance is necessary. And one of their problems at the moment, of course, is to maintain that sense of balance in face of the economic problems and the economic benefits, the cost benefits of tourism, in face of Islamification, in the face of Western culture.
Of course, Indonesia, we should say too, is a collection of over 13,000 islands, a population of 220 million, and it's 90% of that population is Muslim. I'd like to return to our central question, which is, as you said, Cam, tourists are coming back to Bali and came back very strongly after a period of time once the dust had fallen after the bombs had been detonated. What if we have something seismic to stop tourism? For instance, if the tourist planes just stopped coming because people could no longer afford to travel, because oil prices have hiked the seats up so far, because carbon emissions are such a weighty problem that people stop travelling. I know it's a speculative question, but how do you conceive that Bali will handle that?
It would have a devastating economic effect. I really think it would be almost impossible to turn back to the days when Bali was a self-sufficient rice exporter. With population growth, for instance, in, again, Tembuku village, if a family has three or four sons, they can't divide up an acre or a quarter of an acre and expect people to be able to survive. So the way they have survived, and they've been surviving increasingly for the last couple of decades, of course, is one son would or one daughter would go into the tourist industry. The money comes back and helps support the people. It's a tiny island. It's got a spine of marvellous extinct and active volcanoes. The cultivatable area is only the small bit of the south, basically. And there has been deforestation. One of the problems with the water supply now is that farmers, desperate for land, are starting to illegally clear land and put them under oranges or something like that. It's one of the more densely populated places on earth, is Bali. And without natural resources, how do they survive? Mm.
Chris Brazier, what's your observations?
Well, I agree that the impact on Bali would be devastating without tourism there. And it would be much more devastating for other places in the world. It was a question I actually put to George Monbiot, who's a significant environmentalist writer here in the UK, who himself takes the position that people shouldn't be flying for leisure or tourism purposes at all. And I asked him, what about damage done to communities in the majority world that are currently dependent on tourism? He said, I do accept some communities are going to be hit hard by this, but you have to set that against the enormous and much greater damage that will be done to other communities all over the world, and particularly in the majority world, by climate change. That's his perspective. It's not necessarily mine, because I'm not making that case that people shouldn't be flying for tourism purposes at all. I think that they probably should be able to continue to visit places like that. But it is a very difficult point.
Absolutely. And I think that this debate is not prescriptive in any sense, that there's lots of different positions that people can adopt. And really the purpose of what we're talking about today is really to lay out some of those positions so that people can make up their own minds. And in furtherance of that, Cameron, you're an author and journalist, you've been a foreign correspondent, you regularly go to different places in the world. What's your thinking at the moment about how you might travel in the future?
If I could, I'd use an ocean kayak to get down to a place I've got up a hillside in Tasmania with a little spring-fed creek. Look, I really don't think I'll do any more long-distance travel. But I feel selfish in saying this because I've probably travelled more than most people. But mind you, there are so many tourist spots I've never seen because I've been there for a war or something like that.
That was Australian author and journalist Cameron Forbes. His latest book is Under the Volcano, The Story of Bali, published last year by Black Ink. Great to have you on the program today, Cam. Thank you very much for coming in. And do drop in again and tell us about your next adventure, which I know you're considering might be PNG.
It could be PNG, but I'm facing that with my usual fear and diffidence. We'll see.
Bye for now. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking with Chris Brazier about some of the ethical directions that tourists will be navigating now and in the future. Chris, you're widely travelled. What's your most confronting ethical dilemma?
Well, when I think of my most confronting ethical dilemma, I inevitably cast my mind back to my very first experience of visiting a developing country, which was when I was in my early 20s and I visited northern India. This was my first experience of being in the majority world, and I was completely poleaxed by the experience of poverty. And in my experience, ethical dilemmas almost always result from that collision between relative wealth and relative poverty. The naked fact of someone thrusting a foreshortened limb in your face and asking for money was like a dramatization of the vast gulf between rich world and poor world. And although I knew that intellectually, seeing that in practice, I found it completely impossible, frankly, to deal with. In a sense, I feel like my whole life ever since has been an attempt to deal with that gulf between rich and poor and the implications of it for our world. In a practical sense, it led me to the work I do now because I wrote a short story which was related to the experience of how much money you should give to people there. You know, this boy that I met in Pushkar, I felt like I'd built up some sort of relationship with him. How much money should I give to him? You know, given that I had not huge amounts in Western terms, I was traveling as low budget as possible. But I felt like I should give it all of it to him to liberate him from it. In the end, I didn't. I gave a relatively small amount, and I wasn't sure whether that was the right decision. I'm not sure what the right decision would have been, but it's that kind of dilemma. I wrote a story about it, and that story was what I submitted as my sample of writing when I applied for the job at New Internationalist.
Indeed.
And what caught their attention.
Wow, isn't that amazing? How strong do you think the value of tourism is to alleviate poverty?
I think it can have a positive influence, but the ways in which it plays out in most parts of the world act patently not for the benefit of local people. So we can say that the extremes of the Dubai development or the way that they build whole strips of hotels and devastate the landscape in Cancun in Mexico, and that's a standard way of developing tourist resorts, we can say that those are inappropriate ways of doing things at one extreme. And we can say that there are much more positive, locally supportive ways of operating at the other extreme. And they're clearly beneficial to those communities. And clearly we are helping people by doing that. It's that whole grey area in the middle, which kind of tourism is a positive benefit to people and which isn't, a much greyer area, much more difficult to deal with.
That is a perfect place to go now to Bangalore to talk to Leah Card from the Indian NGO Equations, who's just dropped into our airways for a chat. He's going to be talking about the effects that tourism has had on Indian people and places. So let's start firstly, Akad, with the environmental impacts, something that Chris and I haven't been talking about yet. Can you give us an example that's concerned you?
Well, Chris, in India, we are definitely confronted with a serious problem of environmental degradation due to tourism, ranging from many, many different ecosystems that are being targeted for tourism development, from the Himalayas in the north to the Western Ghats in the south to the ecologically fragile islands of Andamans in the east and also Lakshadweep in the west. And in between the various ecosystems that we have in India, these are being targeted for large-scale tourism promotion projects. And we've also had a huge, huge amount of garbage that is being dumped recklessly and irresponsibly by the huge amount of tourists that come into these areas.
I can imagine that must be a huge problem. What happens to that garbage?
Well, it's just allowed to pile up in most of the places. Usually what people do is they either dump it in landfills or they burn it.
What about actual clearance for development purposes and issues concerning land use generally?
Well, in India, the prime tourism destinations are either ecologically sensitive areas or protected areas, like we have national parks and wildlife sanctuaries. We cannot have tourism inside protected areas, but what happens is it usually comes up in the surrounds or the peripheries of the protected areas. Earlier, we had a system of having environmental impact assessment procedures for tourism projects, but the law was amended in 2006. They don't need to prepare environmental impact assessment reports anymore, so they can go ahead and put up tourism projects wherever they want, except for the coastal areas, which still has some kind of regulation that exists, but even that is presently under review. The plans, the projects, the policies, etc., are made at the government level. Communities are not consulted in any tourism project, So they're completely left out of the consultative process. Yeah.
I'm wondering too about the commodification of culture, how culture can actually get skewed from tourism. What are you seeing there?
In Kerala, there is this place called Thrissur. There are many temples in this place. And these temples, they have a common festival, which is called the Thrissur Puram, where, you know, each temple has one or many elephants associated with these temples. So the festival is about bringing together all the elephants and having a grand show. Because of tourism, this whole festival had to be moved from its original schedule, because tourism in Kerala happens around end of the year. So they had to move it from another time to the tourism season. The local people objected and there were demonstrations and so on, but, you know, it continues. But there have been other examples as well where, you know, the communities have taken initiative to develop tourism in their areas. They would say, we do have our own cultural heritage, we have our festivals and so on, which we will not change for tourism. But if tourists happen to be there at that point of time, they're most welcome to come and see it and enjoy it. So there are these two things that are happening parallelly.
What about skill bases as well? That actually changes too, doesn't it? The skills that people are developing can be skewed into tourism and away from other more productive ways of going about one's life. Is that a problem at all in India, Leocard?
When tourism happens in a place which is largely government and private sector driven, then in these places we see this problem happening again, because the communities also look at this as an opportunity for supplementing, you know, their incomes and so on. So there people get co-opted, but they get co-opted into the process and thereby they lose out on the traditional skills and so on. But there have been, again, some examples from different parts of India. I could give you one example from Nagaland, where we had the good fortune of having worked there to have the community bring in tourism. There the community said, you know, the youth of that village will engage in tourism only in the non-harvesting season. So as a supplementary source of income, they will engage with it, but their primary engagement will be with the traditional or the customary practices of that village. So again, there are these two different aspects to this whole thing. But I would agree with you largely that there has been the issue of the traditional skills being lost out. You know, skills of fishing, for example, in Goa, the fishermen say, no, we don't fish anymore because we make more money taking tourists to see dolphins or to see the corals around this place.
Leocard, many people say that and justify the tourism that they undertake as actually assisting in helping communities leverage themselves out of poverty. What's your view about that?
Well, I would say that this statement needs to be supported by data. They need to show that, you know, this is what is happening. But unfortunately, we don't have data from our research that we have been doing from the last 25 years to show that communities have benefited from tourism. Unfortunately, that is still to be proven.
Yes. Lighad, I'd like to bring Chris Brazier into our conversation now. Chris has just been working on a magazine about ethical travelling. Chris, I was very struck by one of the graphs in your magazine about where the tourist dollar ends up for somebody who is going on a safari trip in Kenya. Tell us about that divide up.
All too much of the money spent on holidays by Westerners going abroad ends up in places that we wouldn't expect. I mean, you might expect if you were going on a safari in Kenya that a great deal of that money would be going to the community living around that. But actually they get nothing. The safari company, which may be a local one or it may be owned by a Western company, gets 8 cents out of a dollar for that. The Kenyan government gets 9 cents out of a dollar. Western tour operator gets 20 cents, hotel chain 23 cents, an airline 40 cents of your dollar. So we want to develop a kind of tourism. I think Equations talks about developing a holistic version of tourism or a holistic vision of tourism, which will involve much greater responsiveness to the needs of the communities that are hosting the people coming from abroad.
Tell us about that vision, Lighad.
Well, looking at the whole range of impacts that tourism has had on the society, on the culture, on the economy, on the environment, on policies and institutions, if you look at these six aspects of tourism development, what we envision of the kind of tourism that we would see happening is, first, the decision making is with the community. The people decide whether they want to have tourism in their place or not. That's the basis. Second is to see that wherever tourism happens, it is not socially exploitative. It respects the sensitivity of the community. It respects and gives opportunities for women. Third is environmental sustainability in tourism development. And policies are made in consultation with the people through consultative and democratic and participatory processes. And finally, institutions are given their due right to exercise their rights and their authority in tourism destinations. This is the tourism that we envision.
And that's the ideal. Can you see parts of India which are actually implementing that at the moment, Lighad?
Very, very few areas, actually.
But there
I can
are
count
some?
Them on my fingers. There are just not more than a dozen places in India where this kind of tourism is happening currently. And India is a big country.
And Chris Brazier, when you look at ecotourism around the world and you look at the list that Lighad has just described, are there places that come to mind for you of where those kinds of principles are now in operation?
There are places. I think the term ecotourism is a little bit problematic because over the last few years it's been hijacked more and more by the mainstream tourism industry. And quite often what is termed ecotourism may just be a completely standard package holiday which has, you know, a side trip to the rainforest for the day added onto it, and they call that ecotourism.
Yes,
you know,
right.
That's not what we're talking about. So whatever you term what we're looking at, and what Lighad is aspiring to try and create within India.
Well, Lighad, what do you call it?
We have been experimenting with the terminology of sustainable tourism, but working with a larger profile of sustainable tourism to include much more things than just social, economic, and environmental considerations that UNWTO or WTTC would consider.
Indeed. And Chris, where do you see this sustainable tourism around the world at the moment?
Well, I looked for concrete examples because obviously if we as holidaymakers are looking for places where we can actually be sure that we're helping communities, we need to be identifying particular places. One of the most interesting examples of an alternative kind of tourism, whatever we describe it, was in Thailand, where the Community-Based Tourism Institute, it works with around 50 local communities offering special programs for tourists that are keen to engage with life as it's really lived in Thailand. I sent a journalist in the magazine to visit one of their prime locations in the Andaman island of Koh Yao Noi, and I was interested to have that journalist challenge the locals as to whether these kinds of tourism were actually working for them. And broadly, it came back with a very, very positive picture. It did seem like they had a kind of control, which all too many communities in the rest of the world do not have. In Koh Yao Noi, they're saying just across the water from them is Phuket, which is a major, major tourist destination within Thailand. 5 million tourists last year.
The other side of the coin.
The other side of the coin, and it's just across the water from them.
Yeah.
They're saying it's very important for us to be able to limit the numbers because it would have a devastating impact on community structure. People would tend to be chasing the dollar and getting away from the values that are so important to them at the moment. So obviously, in focusing on a particular example like this, there's a great problem for us in we don't want to focus on a particular community and have thousands and thousands of people then descend on it to see this paradise
absolutely.
And completely disrupt the whole thing in the future. And yet at the same time, you know, we've all had that dilemma in traveling. You discover a place that seems wonderful and its sense of connection with the local environment and local culture is amazing. And yet if you tell anyone about it, then hordes are going to come there. And yet it's wrong to want to keep that for yourself as well. I mean, why shouldn't other people have that wonderful experience too? The whole thing is a minefield, isn't it?
I can imagine too, for communities that are very poor, then alleviating poverty would be such a temptation that all the other principles that you've talked about, Leocard, could fly out the window. Mm-hmm. What's your experience on the ground with that?
Yes, what we also need to be careful about is when we talk about a community, you know, sometimes a community may not be a homogeneous community. It may be very, very, very heterogeneous. And even within the community, there may be people who have more power, right? Who are politically assertive, who are articulate, who can easily hijack the whole aspect of a community-based tourism initiative. Mm. So these things we also need to be careful about.
Just one final question, Leocard. I'm wondering, on balance, mm-hmm. is tourism a good thing or a bad thing for the people of India? What's your gut feeling about it?
I would say tourism is a good thing because people fundamentally have a right to travel. But there are many, many different considerations that we need to take care of. If we have tourism which is good, which is low scale, low infrastructure heavy, low footprint, because you're also talking about climate change now, and tourism happens to be contributing about 5% of the emissions that are contributing towards global climate change. So if all these things are taken care of and tourism is done in a good way, I think tourism is a fantastic thing. But unfortunately, that does not happen. And like I said, there are very, very few examples in India right now which demonstrate that tourism is actually working for the benefit of the communities.
That was Leocard, the Program Coordinator for the Ecosystems, Community and Tourism Program for the Indian NGO Equations, based in Bangalore. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Chris. Hope to catch up with you sometime.
Yes, a tourism trip to Bangalore, hey? In an appropriate way. Bye for now.
Bye.
So do you think that the power of the tourist dollar means that people adopt a way of life that they'd otherwise not pursue?
That's unquestionably true. The impact of tourism in many places in the world is undeniably negative. And because of the kind of ethical problems that we've been talking about, you know, we want to ensure that the kinds of tourism that we're engaging in are actually positive for the communities in which they happen. And in so many places in the world, that's not actually true. For all that more and more people are visiting the South and the flow of tourists is more and more to the majority world. It now has a third of all tourists compared with a quarter in 1990. And a sixth in 1982. So the numbers of people visiting developing countries is much greater with every passing year. And the travel and tourism establishment tend to think, well, that can only be for the benefit because more money is pouring into the countries. Well, in all too many cases, much of the money gets remitted back to the West. Very little of that money is percolating through to the people that matter in the local communities. And so the ethical dilemma about tourism, I think, is we need to be pursuing kinds of tourism, if we're going to go on with visiting other places in the world, that genuinely benefit communities, and all too few developments do that.
Venir a escuchar champeta aquí en Cartagena. ¡Vaya, qué cara!
Was Quien Manda a Quien, performed by Colombia Africa, the Mystic Orchestra from Colombia's Caribbean coast, playing one of the revved up rhythms on their Voodoo Love Inner Campetaland CD. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking about being an ethical traveller. It's no easy ride, and with the barrage of marketing flying around at the moment, it can be hard to work out those experiences destined to do more good than harm. Peter Richards has just dropped in from the Community-Based Tourism Institute in Chiang Mai, Thailand. So let's start with some basics, Peter. What legitimately falls under the banner of ecotourism?
Really, there are lots and lots of different ecotourisms in practice. I mean, there's ecotourism at the best end, which is being pioneered by really responsible tour operators and by the work of the International Ecotourism Society. There are efforts being made there to make all kinds of tourism activities, whether it be community visits or boat trips or diving, as environmentally friendly and as beneficial to the community as possible. But then at the other end of the spectrum, there are plenty of examples of companies that have just harnessed the word ecotourism for their marketing, and there's nothing integrated into their practice to make it environmentally sustainable.
And the interesting thing is that it is a marketing tool, isn't it? Because people who are travelling want to do the right thing, and ecotourism sounds like a way in which they can do it. Can we go through some of the features that make up the principles behind ecotourism and what the add-on effects of community-based ecotourism might be?
This is very academic, but the accepted sort of definition of ecotourism is the International Ecotourism Society. They define ecotourism as responsible travel to natural areas that conserves the environment and improves the well-being of local people. There you can see, okay, it has to be responsible travel, it should have a positive environmental impact, whether that be a minimum impact or funding a conservation or, you know, providing benefit for local people. But what we're doing and where we're really different is that we define the ownership and the management of the program with the community. So rather than saying, you know, how can a community benefit, for example, financially from a tour operator visiting the village, we actually look at the village level and say, okay, do the local people, you know, are they interested in tourism? How can they harness tourism as a tool to achieve their own community development or conservation objectives? What things do they feel comfortable or proud to share with people who are visiting them, and how would it be possible to develop a feasible, interesting, enjoyable tourism program based on those things that the local people already have and already feel proud of and enthusiastic to share.
And this is very much then about local community control over what people are engaging with within their community.
That's right. I mean, we're over here in Thailand, there's well over 12 million tourists a year. The target for last year was 13.8 million.
Wow.
You know, it's a huge amount of tourists. It's not really a question of, you know, communities being out in these utopian places with nobody being in contact. There are tourists who are renting motorbikes, renting cars, renting boats, getting out to these communities off their own back, sometimes using guidebooks or just word of mouth from their friends. So what we're really doing is helping communities to understand how they can take as much control of the situation as possible. We work in many different communities, Chris. We work in, overall, our target area is about 50 communities. So obviously the context from place to place is quite different, and the volume of tourists who are close or far away from the community is quite different.
I can imagine.
The fundamental idea is, how can the community harness tourism as a tool to achieve the things that they want to achieve in terms of development and conservation or community pride?
Can you tell us about some of the more successful community-based ecotourism projects right. that you've been involved with. You're based in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand. So what are some of the projects you're working with that have been successful in your terms for the community?
The team who I'm working with, they're really the pioneers of community-based tourism in Thailand, and they've been doing this for more than 15 years. Originally, the idea was to try and create more public awareness among urban middle-class Thais about, you know, what community work is, the work of NGOs, the fact that, you know, NGOs aren't strange lefties, you know, hanging out in the woods, but they're actually doing a very, very useful and pioneering work, hopefully to try and change the attitude of the urban people here a little bit. And it was very interesting because they organized educational trips, study trips. They took different groups from the city to visit the communities. And originally, it was really only seen as being kind of advocacy and communication. Then they found that by using the same sort of participatory development tools that they normally used in NGO work and adapting those to tourism, that they saw that there are also development outputs from the actual process of managing tourism. So, for example, the community members had to work together to decide, you know, what they felt proud of to share with the guests, to work on management, for example, how to rotate homestays or how to rotate local guides so that the opportunity and the income was fairly distributed. And also just meeting people from outside and seeing that those people were really interested in the local culture. They regarded it in a positive way. That was a very empowering experience for the community.
So take us into your favourite tourism experience.
We've got some great communities, okay, there, for example, in Got Yao Noi. That was a community where the local people formed together in a small fishers federation because large-scale trawlers were coming in with large-scale fishing equipment and literally kind of trawling all of the fish and the coral and the whole coastal environment was being dragged out of existence, basically. And this was having a huge effect on the livelihoods of the small fishers because where they were previously able to find food, you know, for their families quite close to the coast, they were having to go further and further away. So there was already that struggle and that development perspective there, and was really out of sight and out of mind of people in the cities or the media, the socially minded people who may have been motivated to assist that. So with tourism, it was a way of bringing people down to the community, showing them, you know, that this is the situation. There was lots of media coverage. And in the end, the laws which did actually exist to prevent that from happening were enforced. So that community was given the National Geographic and Conservation International World Legacy Award in 2003 for sustainable management of the tourism destination. What we're doing, we really do focus on community-based tourism being a holistic development tool. So, you know, conservation, natural resource management, skills development. The way that we approach tourism is very broad.
It sounds like a way of life rather than just an add-on income. In terms of the tourists who are visiting these areas, Peter, what is the tourist experience for them?
The local people just continue their ordinary way of life. What we call our good things, they are adapted a little bit to create an activity, you know. I mean, somebody could say, look, we're very proud of the mangroves, but the mangroves themselves aren't a tourist activity, but a boat ride would be, for example. We are very conscious of the fact that this kind of experience isn't for everybody, Chris. In terms of marketing, you know, the ideal situation is appropriate tourists and manageable numbers of tourists. So we try and work, for example, with responsible tour operators who have a very clear policy about their position towards the environment and towards the community and so on. We're looking at groups of tourists who are already interested in nature. They're already interested in culture, in a kind of interactive and, you know, face-to-face experience. The tourists, they stay together with a local family. They'll be able to have a language sheet and, you know, practice asking questions to their host family. They might do, you know, some fun activities, for example, a boat ride or a trek. But as well as it being fun, there'll be local community guides who will actually share with them the relationship between the local people and the environment. So it could be Karen Hill Tribe people in the north talking about how they use the different plants for herbal remedies or for food. Or it could be in the mangrove systems, okay, we use this kind of bark for a natural dye, we use this kind of bark for a medicine, this is for building materials, that kind of thing.
I mean, it's a truly unique experience and very much more legitimate than the normal tourist trail would offer people. You were mentioning about income distribution before, Peter. I'm interested in how communities, and often small communities that you're describing now, get together and actually say, well, look, okay, we're going to have X amount of tourists through per year, our family will take Y, your family can take Z. How does that all work? Is that a source of tension within communities?
On one level, it's management. I mean, one of the things that we do is that we help the local people to form a formal community group, formal in terms of inside the community. And then we'll assist that group to develop mechanisms. For example, if we know that there are 10 families who would like to host tourists in a homestay, will give them ideas about how the homestays could be rotated in a way which is, you know, not too difficult to manage, but will generate a fair spread of income, or community guides or boat drivers or car providers or something like that. In terms of saying, you know, how many tourists that the community would like to welcome in a year, this is a little bit more difficult because until people have actually begun to arrive, it's very difficult for the communities to conceptualize, you know, whether they would like to have 4 tourists or 10 tourists or 15 tourists a month or something like that. And it really is also quality rather than quantity. So if you have a group of 20, for example, students who come, you know, once every 2 weeks, very interested, very respectful, curious, they make the community members feel that they really have something to share with the students, that will have a lot less impact than 2 or 3 very obnoxious people coming, you know, once every 3 months. The way that we actually work it is that we'll talk to the communities about each group that are interested to come and visit, and we'll give all the information to the community, and if the community groups say, yep, that sounds interesting, then we'll pilot that. We'll have a process of communication to find a program where both sides feel happy, and then after that, we'll hold a meeting with the community and we'll actually reflect on the real experience that they've had. It's much, much easier to talk about something which has already happened and say, you know, do we want to do this again? Are we interested in working with these kind of people? Or is that really enough of that profile of people?
These are small communities welcoming relatively small amounts of people. As you say, they're tailor-made for each other, which makes the experience even more wonderful. I'm wondering... Mm-hmm. What will happen with international tourism? This is mostly confined at the moment to people within Thailand itself, as I understand it.
Overall, most of the people who are visiting the community-based tourism projects are Thai. We're working on a project at the moment. It's called Spring. It's the Springboard Project for Responsible Inbound International, National and Ground Partnerships. And the idea there is to develop a model working across the supply chain from international tour operators and ground handlers in Thailand and down to the communities, to work out a way of linking the communities to really, you know, good quality, selected, interested international tourists. It really depends, Chris, on the community, to be honest. Some of our communities are located quite close to mass tourism areas, and Got Yao Noi is an example of that. It's only 1 hour by ferry from Phuket, so it's relatively straightforward. You know, if people find out about the project through word of mouth, it's quite easy for them to access the community on their own. And then it really depends on the community group basically being able to say, look, we're full now, we've reached our capacity. And also being able to say, look, if you would like to experience our activities, we have certain rules which we'd like you to abide. For example, it's a Muslim community, so no alcohol. We request that people dress modestly. So some people are, you know, immediately turned on by that, and some people are immediately turned off. Actually, we've just gone into partnership with a research organization in Thailand. Our original organization was called REST, which is the Responsible Ecological Social Tours Project. And it was a development-focused organization. But we've just this year become the Thailand Community-Based Tourism Institute. And we've partnered with a very interesting Thai research organization, which do something called community-based research. They empower community members to do their own small-scale research projects. So rather than academics coming in and doing research, and then the outputs being too difficult for the community to really be able to access, the communities research themselves, and several of the projects have been based on tourism. You know, some of the communities have seen tourism as an opportunity, and they've been interested to research how do we develop, you know, management that can handle the arrival of tourists. So CBTI itself is a new organisation. It's the coming together of community-based research for community-based tourism. It's a mouthful, and the development side of CBT. So, you know, if people are interested to find out more about this, they can have a look at our website, which is cbt-i.org. Or they can contact us at info@cbti.org.
And I'm sure they will, Peter. That was Peter Richards, Marketing Support and Development Coordinator with the Thailand Community-Based Tourism Institute in Chiang Mai in Thailand. Peter, great that you could join us today. I know how busy you are in the field. Thanks very much for being part of the program today.
That's a pleasure, Chris. Thank you very much. Best of luck. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. So time's the thing that's flying by here. Chris Brazier, before we go, Peter's given us some really good tips about being an ethical tourist. Why don't you add your top two?
God, two top tips. That's restricting it a bit, isn't it? You make things difficult. Well, because I've talked about the ethical personal dilemmas of flying, what I'd like to emphasise primarily here is campaign against airport expansion, because the responsibility for the flying issue and its impact on climate change doesn't come down primarily to the individual. It must be to do with government policy. And if we stop the building of extra runways, that is a very practical way of limiting the number of flights that are going to be taken in the future, and we have to stop that expansion. So campaign against expansion of airports and building of extra runways would be point one. And then if we come to actually being there, travelling, well, avoid prepackaged all-in-one holidays, because so little of the money gets to the people at the other end then. Think small. Think in terms of staying in a small place, meeting local people. Don't stick with just a Western tour party. Try and get in touch with the local culture. If you do that, it's much more likely that the money you spend is going to get through to the people where it matters.
Finally, Chris, before we leave this conversation, I noticed that you're advocating a boycott on Lonely Planet guides. That's a pretty big call, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe it is. This was proposed by Tourism Concern, the Trades Union Congress, and the Burma Action Campaign here in Britain. And I work closely with Tourism Concern on this magazine, and so we decided we would join their petition. We feel that, particularly with the situation as terrible as it is in Burma at the moment, with the repression that we all witnessed towards the end of last year, this is a vital time for the international community to be rallying together, to be exerting pressure on that regime to bring it down. Let's put it down for good. The military regime there is being supported by tourism. Most of the tourism dollars spent in Burma find their way into the hands of the regime, support it in one way or another. Lonely Planet guides produce an edition on Myanmar, Burma. Rough guides don't, and I think it's worth pointing up the damage that encouraging tourism there can do.
Yeah, well, you've produced a really thought-provoking magazine, Chris, so thanks very much for coming on the program tonight and talking about it. And for all our friends who are listening, if you want to learn more about the magazine and where to get it, just go to www.newint.org and click on subscriptions and you'll find your way to an offer for a free magazine. Chris, thank you. Goodbye. Thank you very much for being part of the program today.
It's my great pleasure, Chris.
The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. The riotous rhythms you've been hearing today come from the band Colombi Africa, the Mystic Orchestra, straight off the streets surrounding Colombia's Caribbean coastline. Their Voodoo Love Inner Champetaland CD stirs up the music of local slave descendants with a powerful brew of Afro beats. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website's where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Marr. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.